So what can you do? What can you do realistically, you know, that takes into account what you are about?
Alaa Abdel Fattah is arguably the most high-profile political prisoner in Egypt, if not the Arab world. He rose to international prominence during the revolution of 2011. He is a fiercely independent thinker who fuses politics and technology in powerful prose, an activist whose ideas represent a global generation which has only known struggle against a failing system, a public intellectual with the rare courage to offer personal, painful honesty. Alaa's voice came to symbolize much of what was fresh, inspiring, and revolutionary about the uprisings that have defined the last decade. He has been in prison for most of the past 10 years, and since April 2nd, he's been on hunger strike and in urgent need of international help. Time is running out. In May, Alaa was moved to Wadi Notroun, but up until then, he was confined to a solitary cell at Tora prison, known for its maximum security and inhumane treatment of political prisoners. He continues to have limited access to the outside world, and visits with his family are restricted and monitored. For years, Alaa's been denied access to newspapers, books, or exercise time outside of his cell. Now he has more freedom in this prison. It is for the first time that he slept on a bed. And although the conditions under which he continues to be imprisoned appear to have improved, Alaa is still isolated and little information is being shared with his family regarding his health. Since the beginning of Alaa's ordeal, his sisters, Mona and Saneh, together with their mother, Leila Swif, have exhausted almost all possible means to release Alaa. And as they continue to fight against Sisi's regime, stretching their voices against ruling bodies, against buildings and organs of power, calling out the British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss and Sameh Shoukry, her Egyptian counterpart, as it is in their power to call for the release of Alaa, to respond to the urgent questions around the reoccurring violations of human rights, including the case of Alaa and many other political prisoners who are stuck in the limbo of the Egyptian corrupt legal system. This year, Egypt will be hosting COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, whilst, as Alaa puts it in one of his letters to his sister, of all the countries to host, they chose the one banning protest and sending everyone to prison, which tells me how the world is handling this issue. They're not interested in finding a joint solution for the climate. As we speak, on July 28th, Alaa's been on a hunger strike for 119 days, and his life is under a serious threat as he is getting weaker every day. His mother and his sisters have received no news from him since more than 10 days. No letters, no explanation, no proof of life. After waiting for hours for a granted visit with her son, Leila Swif was told that Alaa refuses the visit. This would be the first time ever that Alaa had allegedly refused a visit. Is this another lie? Where is Alaa? Where is Alaa? Where is Alaa, we ask. Time is running out on Alaa. Free Alaa, save Alaa, and all political prisoners.
So what can you do? What can you do realistically, you know, that takes into account what you are about? Well, here is what you can do. Ignore the activists, ignore the revolutionaries. We have to face bullets, we have to face military trials. It doesn't matter really what you do. It doesn't matter if Facebook is going to reveal my information or not. I have to assume that I'm being constantly watched, that everything about me is public. It doesn't matter. But what matters is ordinary users who use your products to practice their agency. when you decide that they cannot decide to choose a pseudonym, then you are negating them the right to negotiate their identity. The right to negotiate your identity is, it's not in the Charter of Human Rights, but it's actually essential to most rights. Negotiated identity is very important. I get to choose whether to reveal who I am and how to reveal who I am and decide who I am on my own terms and on my own basis.
Palestine on my mind. In the beginning, it was on me to pass on the news. Most of my ward mates are not allowed visits, and none of us are allowed newspapers, so my weekly visit had become the primary source of information. News of the Zionists' protracted electoral impasse and the deal of the century kept rolling in. I remember trying to analyze and share the news quickly, broadcasting it by shouting through the hatch in my cell door. That was probably when my ward mates first got to know me. In any case, Palestine was always on my mind. Then came the pandemic, cutting off visits and the news along with them. I protested with a hunger strike that lasted 37 days. I told my cellmate about the time I visited the Empty Stomach Solidarity sit-in tent in Gaza. I've been on hunger strike 4 times since, and each time I remember the Palestinian captive strike. Palestine's always on my mind. Despite the defeats, I'm still grateful to the revolution for all it gave me. For one, I was able to visit Palestine 2x. I never say I visited Gaza. Not only because Palestine is indivisible, but because anyone who visits Gaza cannot but realize that they're in the metropole of Palestine, its beating heart. There, you swap the Palestine of dreams, metaphor, and poetry for the Palestine of flesh and blood and tears and sweat. To isolate me from my ward mates, or perhaps to contain me 1 week into my strike, I was moved to another ward where newspapers were allowed. After 6 months of being denied the printed word, I held a state newspaper in my hand. The first thing I see is a photo of a Palestinian child wearing a cabbage leaf on her face in place of a surgical mask. I scan for news of the pandemic and try to imagine how the world has changed. Try to imagine how my son, Khaled, is coping with the closures, the social distancing, the masks and swabs. I always take pride in the fact that the first stamp on his passport and the last on mine before my imprisonment is from the Rafah border crossing. Khaled was born at the height of the revolution and visited Palestine before he was even 1 year old. On that first visit, I spoke of my family's attempts to live a normal life under exceptional circumstances with no end in sight. I thought that was the Palestinian experience, so I ended my speech with the words, "I am Palestinian." Words that seem so naive now, that the whole world is living in exceptional circumstances with no end in sight. So did we all become Palestinians?
Of course not. Only the children of Gaza are photographed wearing cabbage leaves instead of masks. I'm not Palestinian, and have done nothing worth mentioning for the cause. But when visits started up again and Khaled came in wearing a mask specially designed for the sensitivities related to his autism, it did look to me like that cabbage mask. I'm not a Palestinian, but I'm an Arab, and Palestine's always on my mind. After my hunger strike ended, I was returned to my original cell. My ward mates gave me a big welcome. It was Eid al-Fitr, and we passed the night talking and singing. Then they asked me to sing. I'm not a very good singer, but I contributed for the first time with something other than news and analysis and sang, "I call out to you. Palestine's on my mind." After Eid, I was banned from writing to my family. More accurately, I failed to stay within the fuzzy, ever-shifting red lines that govern what subjects are permissible for correspondence. My last letter had not made it through because I wrote of my concern for my sister Mona's health in the pandemic, wondering if her immune system might have been affected by all the tear gas she inhaled during the early days of the revolution. I don't know if the offense was the reference to the revolution, even in a negative context, or if it was the tear gas that annoyed them. I do know that the quantity of tear gas fired at revolutionaries in Egypt is comparable only to that used against Palestinians in Jerusalem and the West Bank, and that its long-term effects haven't been studied properly. Palestine's always on my mind.
So we went to Palestine. A life's dream that had taken on almost mythical dimensions, but came true with the bus journey and some bureaucracy. We went in search of hills and valleys, za'atar and olive trees, stone houses, mosques and churches, oranges and guns, kafirs and the wreckage of war. Surprise number one. Gaza is normal. A coastal city that resembles Egyptian cities in most details. As if I'm in Agami Abu Talat. Even the people looked, dressed, and talked like people in Egypt. We searched for the siege like curious tourists, though we said we came as comrade siege breakers. On the surface, the blockade was over. The markets are bustling and the supermarkets are fully stocked. The tunnels take care of whatever was missing. The whole way from Palestine, Rafah, to Gaza City, huge lorries are transporting tunnel goods. We philosophize and theorize. So Gaza isn't going hungry. This constant talk of starvation must be to someone's benefit. The first signs of the siege appear at our hotel. The electricity comes and goes, because there's a fuel crisis. And water supplies are limited, and the desalination plants aren't working at capacity. Of course, water and energy problems afflict our Egyptian cities. I'm just not used to encountering them in an expensive hotel in a fancy neighborhood. We philosophize and theorize. Does the siege flatten class distinctions then? And another thing we looked for, with tourists' eyes, was the wreckage of war.
Amputation and cauterization. One is always in the position of having to decide between amputation and gangrene. Amputation is swift, but time may prove that amputation was not necessary, or one may delay the amputation too long. Gangrene is slow, but it is impossible to be sure that one is reading one's symptoms right. The idea of going through life as a cripple is more than one can bear, and equally unbearable is the risk of swelling up slowly in agony with poison. James Baldwin, Notes of a Native Son.
The body, not the soul, is a locus of pain. Homo sapiens is but a rational animal. Modern medicine, with its rationalism, terminology, methods, and machinery, is able to cure all pain. Medicine originated in surgery, in acts of precise violence. A precision that might dictate the removal of an entire diseased organ, not because the organ is disposable, but because it's not essential. As long as you are alive and in possession of your mental faculties, you're fit. Who among us has not dreamt of a decisive delivery from pain? And if the pain lingers after surgery, fear not, for these are ghost pains, more delusions caused by your nervous system. Just be rational about it. If it worries you that your imagination and your mind are one and the same, there's psychiatry for that. Trust the experts and relax. Amputate, then cauterize. And before that, anesthesiaize. And after the deed is done, the painkillers, rehabilitation therapy, and patience will see you through. Life will go on.
Four tweets on state violence, 29th of January, 2013. 11:55 p.m. When the authorities insist that non-violent actions, roadblocks, institutional disruptions, strikes, and rude chants be treated as violent, it follows that non-violence is abandoned because you're going to get a hard sentence anyway. 11:58 p.m. And when the authorities put people who are just defending themselves on trial for murder, then it pushes them from defensive to offensive violence, since they're going to get a hard sentence anyway. 12:11 a.m. And when the authorities fail to observe the laws and regulations that they designed to protect their own interests, it becomes certain that people will completely ignore those laws. 12:11 a.m. When we turn a blind eye to the violence the state exercises in maintaining itself, home demolitions, economic strangulation, the conscription of the central security forces, then the downtrodden will find refuge in violence until you can't but see it.
October 13, 2014. Anyone who tells you that the solution is to apply the law is bullshitting you. The solution is to apply the law to the strong before the weak, to the rich before the poor, to Sisi before the doormen. And that's on condition that the law is consented to by society, particularly by those most affected by it, and has been formulated through a democratic process. And on condition that the law doesn't infringe on the basic rights and freedoms of the individual. And on condition that the law is logical, comprehensible, accessible to people, and known to them before its application, not an ambush that's set for them. And on condition that whoever the law is applied to has access to a fair, unbiased trial that's not rigged, rushed, or repeatedly delayed. And on condition that whoever is subject to the law has the opportunity to change the law and can challenge it on the basis of whether or not it meets standards of public consent and protection of basic rights. And these must be real opportunities. And on condition that the agents of the law are subject to oversight and held accountable and are accepted by those most affected by the law. There are many conditions before applying the law is a solution to anything. But it would be enough to start by applying it to Sisi before the students.
My imminent arrest. 27th November 2013, 12:28 a.m. Deja vu. I'm about to hand myself in to the authorities again on Saturday. My ever imminent arrest is now a running joke in Egypt. Statement of my intention to hand myself in to the prosecutor's office on Saturday, midday. A charge I don't deny and an honour I don't claim. For the second time, the Office of the Public Prosecutor has sent out an arrest warrant through the media. Instead of to my address, well known to them because of their history of fabricating charges against me in the eras of Mubarak, Tantawi and Morsi. For the second time, the Office of the Public Prosecutor lets itself be a tool of government propaganda. This time on the orders of the murderer, Minister of Interior, Mohammed Ibrahim, instead of the Murshid, the supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood. Their reason, that I incited people to demand that trials should be fair and should be the responsibility of an independent civil judiciary. The charge, it appears, is that I participated in inviting people to protest yesterday in front of the Shura Council building against placing, for the second time, an article in the Constitution legitimizing the court-martial of civilians. The strange thing is that both the prosecutor and the Ministry of Interior knew that I was present for 8 hours at First Police Station, New Cairo, in solidarity with the people arrested yesterday on the same charges. But neither the prosecutor nor the MOI ordered my arrest at the time or demanded that I be questioned. This probably means that they intend to put on a show where I play the criminal in hiding. I have officially informed the prosecutor's office by telegram, number 96/381, dated today, and by letter delivered by hand to the public prosecutor, registered number 17138 for 2013. As I have informed the Attorney General for Central Cairo, telegram number 96/382, of my intention to hand myself in on Saturday, 30th November at midday, to the prosecution at their Qasr al-Nil office. The protest people's voice heard needs no permit from the guard. Ala Abd El Fattah, Cairo, 27th November 2013.
New York Times, October 27, 2014. Ala Abd El Fattah, an influential Egyptian blogger, was arrested in court on Monday in Cairo as he appealed a 15-year sentence for violating Egypt's ban on attending unsanctioned protests. Mr. Abd El Fattah, who has been free on bail, was jailed along with 19 other defendants also accused of participating in a demonstration in Cairo late last year. The ruling comes a day after his younger sister, Sanaa Saif, and 22 other activists were sentenced to 3 years in prison for attending a street protest in June, calling for the release of the first group of protesters. He is known to hundreds of thousands of Twitter followers as @Alat, was bizarrely sentenced in absentia in June as he waited outside to be allowed into the courtroom. To ensure that the authorities could not say that he skipped Monday's hearing, he posted a photograph of himself waiting outside the court on Twitter.
Prison has only increased the hatred in me, for hate is the jailer's legacy. Your death has only increased the forgiveness in me, for forgiveness is your legacy. I've come to hate prisons and courts so much, Baba, that I would not wish them even on those I hold responsible for your death. Has prison ever deterred a criminal? Is there any proof of their use? Or has a majority opinion just settled on them? I swear I've never met a single cop who admits that killing Khalid Saeed was a crime. So what do we gain by locking them up? I've never met a single person whose convictions were changed by prison. So what do they gain by locking up their opponents?
I know that despair is treason, but the revolutionary in my country, even if he is a sinless prophet, who sees the tyrant empowered at the oppressed's command, amid the rejoicing of the poor, will lose his faith. They say that despair is treason. I was never comfortable with the slogan. I understand its motivation, but I'm worried the word is used lightly. The denial of a natural feeling scares me. It reminds me of angry crowds circling the square, carrying a bloodied shirt, searching for any traitor who allowed despair to steal into his mind or heart. They ruined the sweetness of the square. We pretend to forget them while we weave the myth of those 18 shining days. But they are always in my nightmares. In my nightmares, they surround my mother. They want to throw her out of the square. Laila Swaif resists them. Laila Swaif was born from the womb of defeat, and so went into the square in 1972 and never came back. Despair never dared come near her, yet they called her a traitor to exercise their own doubts and fears. From my mother, I inherited a stone cake, and from my father, a prison cell. And in line with our traditions, I was given an inheritance better than my sisters. For they inherited morgues and victims of torture and the embrace of grieving mothers. I'm scared to even ask about their nightmares.
We live in hugely reactionary times. My defeat when it was inevitable. In my isolation, I can only build a fragmented picture of what the world outside looks like. And when it comes to tech, that picture is solely based on which views and actions of governments and giant tech companies manage to filter through state-controlled media, not what people in communities are doing and saying. On the simple question of how to finally retire the hashtag #FreeAlaa, you have little, if any, agency, but on the question of whether the internet is a space in which we come together to enjoy, assert, practice, and defend universal rights and freedoms, you have a lot of agency. Unlike me, you have not yet been defeated. Fix your own democracy. This has always been my answer to the question, how can we help? I still believe it's the only possible answer. Not only is where you live, work, vote, pay tax, and organize a place where you have more influence, but a setback for human rights in a place where democracy has deep roots is certain to be used as an excuse for even worse violations in societies where rights are more fragile. I trust recent events made it evident that there is much that needs fixing.
A handwritten note. Hi, I've not seen your letter yet, so I can't respond. And I don't know which one of you is here, but I think it's Mama. I'm a bit worried at the thought of you waiting out there in this rain. It looks like the whole place has drowned, as usual. But honestly, when it was raining, it was joyful, and the smell of the wet dust was good, and the sound of people raising prayers was inspiring. You miss being part of nature and the climate, but this rain is making itself felt through the walls. I hope you're all well. My health is good. That's all I can say. The day of my birthday was a bit dramatic and I couldn't celebrate, but the banana cake made up for things a bit. I try to energize my head in the absence of books by remembering stories from history, sometimes by chattering on about science. My imagination can't really engage with post-release dreams, but, you know, one tries to find reason for optimism in the ebbing of the right-wing wave in the world and to believe its effects will reach us. Of course, I'm used to Gramsci's method regarding the pessimism of the mind and the optimism of the will. But there's such negation of the will here that I need to train myself into an optimism of the mind before I mess up my colleagues. That's all. I'm generally fine, and I love you and miss you. November 2020.
We are calling for the immediate release of Alaa Abd El Fattah. Join us on freealaa.net to find out how you can help.